Billy turned back to them, and Stu limped over to where he stood. "Billy, Fran was going to have a baby." Billy grew very still, and then he whispered, "Oh, shit, I forgot about that."
"She's had it?"
George Richardson can tell you, Stu. Or Dan Lathrop, he's our new doc. We got him about 4 weeks after you guys left. Used to be a nose, throat, and ears man, but he's pretty good."
Stu gave Billy a brisk shake, cutting off his almost frantic babble.
"What's wrong?" Tom asked. "Is something wrong with Franny?"
"Talk to me, Billy," Stu said. "Please."
"Fran's okay," Billy said. "She's gonna be fine."
"That what you heard?"
"No, I saw her. Me and Tony Donahue, we went up together with some flowers from the greenhouse. The greenhouse is Tony's project. He's got all kinds of stuff growing there, not just flowers. The only reason she's still in is because she had to have a Roman birth."
"A cesarean section?"
"Yeah, right. Because the baby came the wrong way. But no sweat. We went to see her 3 days after she had the baby. It was January 7th we went up, 2 days ago. We brought her some roses. We figured she could use some cheering up because—"
"The baby died?" Stu asked dully.
"It's not dead," Billy said, and then he added with great reluctance, "Not yet."
Stu suddenly felt far away, rushing through the void. He heard laughter and the howling of wolves. Billy said in a miserable rush,
"It's got the flu. It's got Captain Trips. It's the end for all of us. That's what people are saying. Franny had him on the 4th, a boy, 6 pounds 9 ounces, and at first he was okay, and I guess everybody in the zone got drunk. Dick Ellis said it was like VE Day and VJ Day all rolled into one, and then on the 6th he just got it."
"Yeah, man," Billy said, and his voice began to hitch and thicken.
"He got it. Oh, shit, ain't that some welcome home? I'm so fucking sorry, Stu."
Stu reached out, found Billy's shoulder, and pulled him closer.
"At first everybody was saying he might get better. Maybe it's just the ordinary flu, or bronchitis, maybe the croup. But the docs, they said newborn babies almost never get those things. It's like a natural immunity because they're so little. And both George and Dan, they saw so much of the super flu last year."
"That it would be hard for them to make a mistake," Stu finished for him.
"Yeah," Billy whispered. "You got it."
"What a bitch," Stu muttered.
He turned away from Billy and began to limp down the road again. "Stu, where are you going?"
"To the hospital," Stu said. "To see my woman."
Chapter 76
Fran lay awake with the reading lamp on. It cast a pool of bright light over the left side of the clean white sheet that covered her. In the center of the light, face down, was an Agatha Christie. She was awake, but slowly drifting off, in that state where memories clarify magically as they begin to transmute themselves into dreams. She was going to bury her father. What happened after that didn't matter, but she was going to drag herself out of the shockwave enough to get that done. The act of love. When that was done, she could cut herself a piece of strawberry rhubarb pie. It would be large, it would be juicy, and it would be very, very bitter. Marcy had been in half an hour ago to check on her, and Fran had asked,
"Is Peter dead yet?"
And even as she spoke, time seemed to double so that she wasn't sure if she meant Peter the baby or Peter the baby's grandfather, now deceased.
"Shh, he's fine," Marcy had said,
but Franny had seen a more truthful answer in Marcy's eyes. The baby she had made with Jess Ryder was engaged in dying somewhere behind 4 glass walls. Perhaps Lucy's baby would have better luck. Both of its parents had been immune to Captain Trips. The zone had written off her Peter now and had pinned its collective hopes on those women who had conceived after July 1st of last year. It was brutal, but completely understandable. Her mind drifted, cruising at some low level along the border of sleep, conning the terrain of her past and the landscape of her heart. She thought about her mother's parlor where seasons passed in a dry age. She thought about Stu's eyes, about the first sight of her baby, Peter Goldsmith Redman. She dreamed that Stu was with her, in her room.
"Fran?"
Nothing had worked out the way it should have. All of the hopes had turned out to be phony, as false as those audio-animatronic animals at Disney World. Just a bunch of clockwork, a cheat, a false dawn, a false pregnancy, a... Hey, Franny. In her dream, she saw that Stu had come back. He was standing in the doorway of her room, wearing a gigantic fur parka. Another cheat. But she saw that the dream Stu had a beard. Wasn't that funny? She began to wonder if it was a dream when she saw Tom Cullen standing behind him. And was that Kojak sitting at Stu's heel? Her hand flew suddenly up to her cheek and pinched viciously, making her left eye water. Nothing changed.
"Stu?" she whispered.
"Oh my God, is it Stu?" His face was deeply tanned, except for the skin around his eyes, which might have been covered by sunglasses. That was not a detail you would expect to notice in a dream. She pinched herself again. "It's me," Stu said, coming into the room. "Stop working yourself over, honey." His limp was so severe he was nearly stumbling.
"Franny, I'm home."
"Stu," she cried. "Are you real? If you're real, come here." He went to her then and held her.
Chapter 77
Stu was sitting in a chair drawn up to Fran's bed when George Richardson and Dan Lathrop came in. Fran immediately seized Stu's hand and squeezed it tightly, almost painfully. Her face was set in rigid lines, and for a moment Stu saw what she would look like when she was old. For a moment she looked like Mother Abigail.
"Stu," George said, "I heard about your return. Miraculous. I can't tell you how glad I am to see you. We all are."
George shook his hand and then introduced Dan Lathrop. Dan said,
"We've heard there was an explosion in Las Vegas. You actually saw it?"
"Yes."
"People around here seem to think it was a nuclear blast. Is that true?"
"Yes."
George nodded at this, then seemed to dismiss it and turned to Fran.
"How are you feeling?"
"All right. Glad to have my man back."
"What about the baby?"
"Actually," Lathrop said, "that's what we're here about."
Fran nodded.
"Dead?"
George and Dan exchanged a glance.
"Franny, I want you to listen carefully and try not to misunderstand anything I say."
Lightly, with suppressed hysteria, Fran said,
"If he's dead, just tell me."
"Fran," Stu said.
"Peter seems to be recovering," Dan Lathrop said mildly.
There was a moment of utter shocked silence in the room. Fran, her face pale and oval below the dark chestnut mass of her hair on the pillow, looked up at Dan as if he had suddenly begun to spout some sort of lunatic doggerel. Someone, either Lori Constable or Marcy Spruce, looked into the room and then passed on. It was a moment that Stu never forgot.
"What?"
Fran whispered at last.
George said, "You mustn't get your hopes up."
"You said recovering," Fran said.
Her face was flatly stunned. Until this moment, she hadn't realized how much she had resigned herself to the baby's death.
George said, "Both Dan and I saw thousands of cases during the epidemic, Fran. You notice I don't say treated because I don't think either of us ever changed the course of the disease by a jot or a tittle in any patient. Fair statement, Dan?"
"Yes."
The "I want" line that Stu had first noticed in New Hampshire hours after meeting her now appeared on Fran's forehead.
"Will you get to the point, for heaven's sake?"
"I'm trying, but I have to be careful, and I'm going to be careful," George said. "This is your son's life we're discussing, and I'm not going to let you press me. I want you to understand the drift of our thinking. Captain Trips was a shifting antigen flu, we think now. Now, every kind of flu, the old flu, had a different antigen. That's why it kept coming back every 2 or 3 years or so, in spite of flu vaccinations. There would be an outbreak of A-type flu, Hong Kong flu that was, and you'd get a vaccination for it. And then 2 years later a B-type strain would come along and you'd get sick unless you got a different vaccination. But you'd get well again,
Dan broke in, because eventually your body would produce its own antibodies. Your body changed to cope with the flu. With Captain Trips, the flu itself changed every time your body came to a defense posture. In that way, it was more similar to the AIDS virus than to the common sorts of flu our bodies have become used to. And as with AIDS, it just went on shifting from form to form until the body was worn out. The result, inevitably, was death.
Then why didn't we get it? Stu asked. George said,
We don't know. I don't think we're ever going to know. The only thing we can be sure about is that the immunes didn't get sick and then throw the sickness off. They never got sick at all. Which brings us to Peter again. Dan?
Yes. The key to Captain Trips is that people seemed to get almost better, but never completely better. Now, this baby, Peter, got sick 48 hours after he was born. There was no doubt at all that it was Captain Trips. The symptoms were classic. But those discolorations under the line of the jaw, which both George and I had come to associate with the fourth and terminal stage of superflu, they never came. On the other hand, his periods of remission have been getting longer and longer.
I don't understand, Fran said, bewildered.
What?
Every time the flu shifts, Peter is shifting right back at it, George said. There's still the technical possibility that he might relapse, but he has never entered the final critical phase. He seems to be wearing it out.
There was a moment of total silence.
Dan said, You've passed on half an immunity to your child, Fran. He got it, but we think now he's got the ability to lick it. We theorize that Mrs. Wentworth's twins had the same chance, but with the odds stacked much more radically against them. And I still think that they may not have died of the superflu, but of complications arising from the superflu. That's a very small distinction, I know, but it may be crucial.
And the other women who got pregnant by men who weren't immune? Stu asked.
We think they'll have to watch their babies go through the same painful struggle, George said, and some of the children may die. It was touch and go with Peter for a while, and maybe again, from all we know now. But very shortly we're going to reach the point where all the fetuses in the free zone, in the world, are the product of two immune parents. And while it wouldn't be fair to pre-guess, I'd be willing to lay money that when that happens, it's going to be our ball game. In the meantime, we're going to be watching Peter very closely.
And we won't be watching him alone, if that's any added consolation, Dan added.
In a very real sense, Peter belongs to the entire free zone right now.
Fran whispered, I only want him to live because he's mine and I love him.
She looked at Stu.
And he's my link with the old world. He looks more like Jess than me and I'm glad. That seems right. Do you understand, love?
Stu nodded, and a strange thought occurred to him. How much he would like to sit down with Hap and Norm Bruett and Vic Palfrey and have a beer with them and watch Vic make one of his shitty-smelling home-rolled cigarettes and tell them how all of this had come out. They had always called him Silent Stu. Old Stu, they said. Wouldn't say shit if he had a mouthful. But he would talk their ears off their heads. He would talk all night and all day. He grasped Fran's hand blindly, feeling the sting of tears.
We've got rounds to make, George said, getting up. But we'll be monitoring Peter closely, Fran. You'll know for sure when we know for sure.
When could I nurse him, if he doesn't...
A week, Dan said.
But that's so long.
It's going to be long for all of us. We've got 61 pregnant women in the zone, and 9 of them conceived before the superflu. It's going to be especially long for them. Stu, it was good meeting you.
Dan held out his hand, and Stu shook it. He left quickly, a man with a necessary job to do and anxious to do it.
George shook Stu's hand and said, I'll see you by tomorrow afternoon at the latest, hmm? Just tell Lori when would be the most convenient time for you.
What for?
The leg, George said. It's bad, isn't it?
Not too bad.
Stu, Franny said, sitting up.
What's wrong with your leg?
Broken, badly set, overtaxed, George said. Nasty. But it can be fixed.
Well,
Stu said.
Well, nothing. Let me see it, Stuart.
The I want line was back.
Later, Stu said.
George got up. See Laurie, all right?
He will, Franny said.
Stu grinned. I will. Boss lady says so.
It's very good to have you back, George said.
A thousand questions seemed to stop just behind his lips. He shook his head slightly and then left, closing the door firmly behind him.
Let me see you walk, Franny said.
The I want line still creased her brow.
Hey, Franny, come on, let me see you walk.
He walked for her. It was a little like watching a sailor make his way across a pitching foredeck. When he turned back to her, she was crying. Oh, Franny, don't do that, honey.
I have to,
she said, and put her hands over her face. He sat beside her and took her hands away.
No, no, you don't.
She looked at him nakedly, her tears still flowing.
So many people dead. Harold, Nick, Susan. And what about Larry? What about Glenn and Ralph?
I don't know.
And what's Lucy going to say? She'll be here in an hour. She comes every day, and she's 4 months pregnant herself. Stu, when she asks you...
They died over there, Stu said, speaking more to himself than to her. That's what I think. What I know in my heart.
Don't say it that way, Fran begged. Not when Lucy gets here, it will break her heart if you do.
I think they were the sacrifice. God always asks for a sacrifice. His hands are bloody with it. Why? I can't say. I'm not a very smart man. Perhaps we brought it on ourselves. All I know for sure is that the bomb went off over there instead of over here, and we're safe for a while. For a little while.
Is Flag gone? Really gone?
I don't know. I think we'll have to stand a watch for him. And in time, someone will have to find the place where they made the germs like Captain Tripp's and fill that place up with dirt and seed the ground with salt and then pray over it. Pray for all of us. Much later that evening, not long before midnight, Stu pushed her down the silent hospital corridor in a wheelchair. Laurie Constable walked with them, and Fran had seen to it that Stu had made his appointment.
You look like you're the one that should be in that wheelchair, Stu Redman, Laurie said.
Right now it doesn't bother me at all, Stu said. They came to a large glass window that looked in on a room done in blues and pinks. A large mobile hung from the ceiling. Only one crib was occupied, in the front row. Stu stared in, fascinated. Goldsmith Redman, Peter, the card at the front of the crib read. Boy, birth weight, 6 pounds, 9 ounces. Mother, Frances Goldsmith, room 209. Father, Jesse Ryder, deceased. Peter was crying. His small hands were balled into fists. His face was red. There was an amazing swatch of dark black hair on his head. His eyes were blue, and they seemed to look directly into Stu's eyes, as if accusing him of being the author of all his misery. His forehead was creased with a deep vertical slash. An I want line. Franny was crying again.
Franny, what's wrong? All those empty cribs, she said, and her voice became a sob. That's what's wrong. He's all alone in there. No wonder he's crying, Stu. He's all alone. All those empty cribs, my God.
He won't be alone for very long, Stu said, and put an arm around her shoulders. And he looks to me as if he's going to bear up just fine. Don't you think so, Laurie? But Laurie had left the two of them alone in front of the nursery window. Wincing at the pain in his leg, Stu knelt beside Franny and hugged her clumsily, and they looked in at Peter in mutual wonder, as if the child were the first that had ever been gotten upon the earth. After a bit, Peter fell asleep, small hands clenched together on his chest, and still they watched him and wondered that he should be there at all.
Chapter 78. May Day. They had finally put the winter behind them. It had been long, and to Stu, with his East Texas background, it had seemed fantastically hard.
2 days after his return to Boulder, his right leg had been rebroken and reset, and this time encased in a heavy plaster cast that had not come off until early April. By then the cast had begun to look like some incredibly complex road map. It seemed that everyone in the zone had autographed it, although that was a patent impossibility. The pilgrims had begun to trickle in again by the 1st of March, and by the day that had been the cutoff for income tax returns in the old world, the free zone was nearly 11,000 strong, according to Sandy Duchesne, who now headed a census bureau of a dozen persons, a bureau that had its own computer terminal at the First Bank of Boulder. Now he and Fran stood with Lucy Swan in the picnic area halfway up Flagstaff Mountain and watched the May Day chase. All the zone's children appeared to be involved, and not a few of the adults. The original May basket, bedecked with crepe ribbons and filled with fruit and toys, had been hung on Tom Cullen. It had been Fran's idea. Tom had caught Bill Gerringer. Despite Billy's self-conscious disclaimer that he was too old for such kid games, he had joined with a will. And together they had caught the Upshaw boy. Or was it Upson? Stu had trouble keeping them all straight. And the three of them had tracked down Leo Rockway hiding behind Brentner Rock. Tom himself had put the tag on Leo. The chase ranged back and forth over West Boulder, gangs of kids and adolescents surging up and down the streets that were still mostly empty, Tom bellowing and carrying his basket. And at last it led back up here, where the sun was hot and the wind blew warm. The band of tagged children was some 200 strong, and they were still in the process of tracking down the last half dozen or so that were still out. In the process, they were scaring up dozens of deer that wanted no part of the game. 2 miles farther up, at Sunrise Amphitheater, a huge picnic lunch had been spread where Harold Lauder had once waited for just the right moment to speak into his walkie-talkie. At noon, 2,000 or 3,000 people would sit down together and look east toward Denver and eat venison and deviled eggs and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and fresh pie for dessert. It might be the last mass gathering the zone would ever have, unless they all went down to Denver and got together in the stadium where the Broncos had once played football. Now, on May Day, the trickle of early spring had swelled to a flood of immigrants. Since April 15th, another 8,000 had come in, and they were now 19,000 or so, temporarily at least. Sandy's Census Bureau could not keep up. A day when only 500 came in was a rare day. In the playpen, which Stu had brought up and covered with a blanket, Peter began to cry lustily. Fran moved toward him, but Lucy, mountainous and 8 months pregnant, was there first. "I warn you," Fran said, "it's his diapers. I can tell just by the way he sounds." "Looking at a little poo isn't going to cross my eyes." Lucy lifted an indignantly crying Peter from the playpen and shook him gently back and forth in the sunlight. "Hi, baby. What you doing? Not too much?" Peter blatted. Lucy set him down on another blanket they had brought up for a changing table. Peter began to crawl away, still blatting. Lucy turned him over and began to unsnap his blue corduroy pants. Peter's legs waved in the air. "Why don't you two go for a walk?" Lucy said. She smiled at Fran, but Stu thought the smile was sad. "Why don't we just do that?" Fran agreed, and took Stu's arm. Stu allowed himself to be walked away. They crossed the road and entered a mild green pasture that climbed upward at a steep angle under the moving white clouds and bright blue sky.
"What was that about?" Stu asked.
"Pardon me?" But Fran looked just a trifle too innocent.
"That look."
"What look?"
"I know a look when I see one," Stu said. "I may not know what it means, but I know it when I see it."
"Sit down with me, Stu."
"Like that, is it?"
They sat down and looked east, where the land fell away in a series of swoops to flatlands that faded into a blue haze. Nebraska was out there in that haze somewhere. "It's serious, and I don't know how to talk to you about it, Stuart."
"Well, you just go on the best you can," he said, and took her hand.
Instead of speaking, Fran's face began to work.
A tear spilled down her cheek, and her mouth drew down, trembling.
Fran.
No, I won't cry, she said angrily. And then there were more tears, and she cried hard in spite of herself. Bewildered, Stu put an arm around her and waited. When the worst seemed to be over, he said,
Now tell me, what's this about?
I'm homesick, Stu. I want to go back to Maine.
Behind them, the children whooped and yelled. Stu looked at her, utterly flabbergasted. Then he grinned a little uncertainly.
That's it? I thought you must have decided to divorce me at the very least. Not that we've ever actually had the benefit of the clergy, as they say.
I won't go any place without you, she said.
She had taken a Kleenex from her breast pocket and was wiping her eyes with it.
Don't you know that?
I guess I do.
But I want to go back to Maine. I dream about it.
Don't you ever dream about East Texas, Stu? Arnett?
No, he said truthfully. I could live just as long and die just as happy if I never saw Arnett again.
Did you want to go to Ogunquit, Franny?
Eventually, maybe, but not right away.
I'd want to go to Western Maine, what they called the Lakes region. You were almost there when Harold and I met you in New Hampshire.
There's some beautiful places, Stu. Bridgeton, Sweden, Castle Rock. The lakes would be jumping with fish, I'd imagine. In time, we might settle on the coast, I suppose. But I couldn't face that first year. Too many memories. It would be too big at first. The sea would be too big.
She looked down at her nervously plucking hands.
If you want to stay here, help them get it going, I understand. The mountains are beautiful too, but it just doesn't seem like home.
He looked east and discovered he could at last name something he had felt stirring around in himself since the snow had begun to melt. An urge to move on. There were too many people here. They weren't exactly stepping all over each other, at least not yet. But they were beginning to make him feel nervous. There were zoners, and so they had begun to call themselves, who could cope with that sort of thing, who actually seemed to relish it. Jack Jackson, who headed the new Free Zone Committee, now expanded to 9 members, was one. Brad Kitchener was another. Brad had 100 projects going, and all the warm bodies he could use to help with each of them. It had been his idea to get one of the Denver TV stations going. It showed old movies every night from 6 to 1 a.m. with a 10-minute news broadcast at 9 o'clock. And the man who had taken over the marshalling chore in Stu's absence, Hugh Petrella, was not the sort of man Stu much cottoned to. The very fact that Petrella had campaigned for the job made Stu feel uneasy. He was a hard, puritanical fellow with a face that looked as if it had been carved by licks of a hatchet. He had 17 deputies and was pushing for more at each Free Zone committee meeting. If Glenn had been here, Stu thought he would have said that the endless American struggle between the law and freedom of the individual had begun again. Petrella was not a bad man, but he was a hard man, and Stu supposed that, with Hugh's sure belief that the law was the final answer to every problem, he made a better marshal than Stu himself ever would have been.
I know you've been offered a spot on the committee, Fran was saying hesitantly.
I got the feeling that was an honorary thing, didn't you?
Fran looked relieved.
Well,
I got the idea they'd be just as happy if I turned it down. I'm the last holdover from the old committee, and we were a crisis committee.
Now there's no crisis.
What about Peter, Franny?
I think he'll be old enough to travel by June, she said, and I'd like to wait until Lucy has her baby.
There had been 18 births in the zone since Peter had come into the world on January 4th. 4 had died. The rest were just fine. The babies born of the plague-immune parents would begin to arrive very soon, and it was entirely possible that Lucy's would be the first. She was due on June 14th.
"What would you think about leaving on July 1st?" he asked.
Fran's face lit up.
"You will? You want to?"
"Sure."
"You're not just saying that to please me."
"No," he said. "Other people will be leaving, too. Not many, not for a while, but some."
She flung her arms around his neck and hugged him.
"Maybe it will be just a vacation," she said. "Or maybe...
Maybe we'll really like it.
She looked at him timidly.
Maybe we'll want to stay.
He nodded.
Maybe so.
But he wondered if either of them would be content to stay in one place for any run of years. He looked over at Lucy and Peter. Lucy was sitting on the blanket, bouncing Peter up and down. He was giggling and trying to catch Lucy's nose.
Have you ever thought that he might get sick?
And you? What if you catch pregnant again? She smiled.
There are books. We can both read them. We can't live our lives afraid, can we?
No, I suppose not.
Books and good drugs. We can learn to use them, and as for the drugs that have gone over, we can learn to make them again. When it comes to getting sick and dying...
She looked back toward the large meadow where the last of the children were walking toward the picnic area, sweaty and winded.
That's going to happen here, too. Remember Rich Moffat?
He nodded.
And Shirley Hammett?
Yes.
Shirley had died of a stroke in February. Franny took his hands. Her eyes were bright and shining with determination.
I say we take our chances and live our lives the way we want.
All right. That sounds good to me. That sounds right.
I love you, East Texas.
That goes back to you, ma'am.
Peter had begun to cry again.
Let's go see what's wrong with the Emperor, she said, getting up and brushing grass from her slacks.
He tried to crawl and bumped his nose, Lucy said, handing Peter to Fran.
Poor baby.
Poor baby, Fran agreed, and put Peter on her shoulder. He laid his head familiarly against her neck, looked at Stu, and smiled.
Stu smiled back.
Peek, baby, he said, and Peter laughed.
Lucy looked from Fran to Stu and back to Fran again.
You're going, aren't you? You talked him into it.
I guess she did, Stu said. We'll stick around long enough to see which flavor you get, though.
I'm glad, Lucy said.
From far off, a bell began to clang in strong, musical notes which seemed to beat themselves into the day.
Lunch, Lucy said, getting up. She patted her gigantic belly. Hear that, Junior? We're going to eat. Ow! Don't kick. I'm going.
Stu and Fran got up, too.
Here, you take the boy, Fran said.
Peter had gone to sleep. The three of them walked up the hill to Sunrise Amphitheater together. Dusk of a summer evening. They sat on the porch as the sun went down and watched Peter as he crawled enthusiastically through the dust of the yard. Stu was in a chair with a caned seat. The caning had been belled downward by years of use. Sitting at his left was Fran in the rocker. In the yard, to Peter's left, the donut-shaped shadow of the tire swing printed its depthless image in the ground in the day's kind last light.
She lived here a long time, didn't she? Fran asked softly.
Long and long, Stu agreed, and pointed at Peter. He's getting all dirty.
There's water. She had a hand pump. All it takes is priming. All the conveniences, Stuart.
He nodded and said no more. He lit his pipe, taking long puffs. Peter turned around to make sure they were still there.
Hi, baby, Stu said, and waved.
Peter fell over. He got back up on his hands and knees and began to creep around in a large circle again. Standing at the end of the dirt road that cut through the wild corn was a small Winnebago camper with a winch attachment on the front. They were sticking to secondary roads, but the winch had still come in handy again and again.
Are you lonely? Fran asked.
No. I may be in time.
Scared about the baby?
She patted her stomach, which was still perfectly flat.
Nope.
It's going to put a scab on Pete's nose.
It'll fall off. And Lucy had twins.
He smiled at the sky.
Can you imagine it?
I saw them.
Seeing's believing, they say.
When do you think we'll be in Maine, Stu?
He shrugged. Near the end of July. In plenty of time to start getting ready for winter, anyhow.
You worried?
Nope,
she said, mocking him. She stood up.
Look at him, he's getting filthy.
Told you.
He watched her go down the porch steps and gather up the baby.
He sat there, where Mother Abigail had sat often and long, and thought about the life that was ahead of them. He thought it would be all right. In time, they would have to go back to Boulder, if only so their children could meet others their own age and court and marry and make more children. Or perhaps part of Boulder would come to them. There had been people who had questioned their plans closely, almost cross-examining them, but the look in their eyes had been one of longing rather than contempt or anger. Stu and Fran weren't the only ones with a touch of the wanderlust, apparently. Harry Dunbarton, the former spectacles salesman, had talked about Minnesota, and Mark Zellman had spoken of Hawaii, of all places, learning how to fly a plane and going to Hawaii.
"Mark, you'd kill yourself," Fran had scolded indignantly.
Mark had only smiled slyly and said, "Look who's talking, Franny." And Stan Nagotny had begun to talk thoughtfully about going south, perhaps stopping at Acapulco for a few years, then maybe going on down to Peru.
"I tell you what, Stu," he said, "all these people make me nervous as a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. I don't know one person in a dozen anymore. People lock their houses at night. Don't look at me that way, it's a fact. Listening to me, you'd never think I lived in Miami, which I did for 16 years, and locked the house every night, but damn, that was one habit I liked losing. Anyway, it's just getting too crowded. I think about Acapulco a lot. Now, if I could just convince Janie—"
It wouldn't be such a bad thing, Stu thought, watching Fran pump water, if the free zone did fall apart. Glenn Bateman would think so, he was quite sure. Its purpose had been served, Glenn would say. Best to disband before what? Well, at the last Free Zone committee meeting before he and Fran had left, Hugh Petrella had asked for and had been given the authorization to arm his deputies. It had been the cause in Boulder during his and Fran's last few weeks there. Everyone had taken a side. In early June, a drunk had manhandled one of the deputies and had thrown him through the plate glass window of the Broken Drum, a bar on Pearl Street. The deputy had needed over 30 stitches and a blood transfusion. Petrella had argued it never would have happened if his man had had a police special to point at the drunk. And so the controversy raged. There were plenty of people, and Stu was among them, although he kept his opinions mostly to himself, who believed that if the deputy had had a gun, the incident might have ended with a dead drunk instead of a wounded deputy. "What happens after you give guns to the deputies?" he asked himself. "What's the logical progression?" And it seemed that it was the scholarly, slightly dry voice of Glenn Bateman that spoke an answer. "You give them bigger guns, and police cars. And when you discover a free zone community down in Chile or maybe up in Canada, you make Hugh Petrella the Minister of Defense just in case, and maybe you start sending out search parties. Because, after all, that stuff is lying around, just waiting to be picked up." "Let's put him to bed," Fran said, coming up the steps.
"Okay.
Why are you sitting around in such a blue study, anyhow?"
"Was I?"
"You certainly were." He used his fingers to push the corners of his mouth up in a smile.
"Better?"
"Much. Help me put him in."
"My pleasure."
As he followed her inside Mother Abigail's house, he thought it would be better, much better, if they did break down and spread. Postpone organization as long as possible. It was organization that always seemed to cause the problem. When the cells began to clump together and grow dark, you didn't have to give the cops guns until the cops couldn't remember the names, the faces. Fran lit a kerosene lamp and it made a soft yellow glow. Peter looked up at them quietly, already sleepy. He had played hard. Fran slipped him into a nightshirt.
"All any of us can buy is time," Stu thought. "Peter's lifetime, his children's lifetimes, maybe the lifetimes of my great-grandchildren. Until the year 2100, maybe. Surely no longer than that. Maybe not that long. Time enough for poor old Mother Earth to recycle herself a little. A season of rest."
"What?" she asked, and he realized he had murmured it aloud.
"A season of rest," he repeated.
"What does that mean?"
"Everything," he said.
and took her hand. Looking down at Peter, he thought, "Maybe if we tell him what happened, he'll tell his own children. Warn them. Dear children, the toys are death. They're flash burns and radiation sickness and black choking plague. These toys are dangerous. The devil in men's brains guided the hands of God when they were made. Don't play with these toys, dear children, please, not ever. Not ever again. Please, please learn the lesson. Let this empty world be your copybook."
"Franny," he said, and turned her around so he could look into her eyes.
"What, Stuart? Do you think people ever learn anything?"
She opened her mouth to speak, hesitated, fell silent. The kerosene lamp flickered. Her eyes seemed very blue.
"I don't know," she said at last.
She seemed unpleased with her answer. She struggled to say something more, to illuminate her first response, and could only say it again.
"I don't know."
The circle closes. "We need help," the poet reckoned. Edward Dorn. He awoke at dawn. He had his boots on. He sat up and looked around himself. He was on a beach as white as bone. Above him, a ceramic sky of cloudless blue stood tall and far. Beyond him, a turquoise sea broke far out upon a reef and then came in gently, surging up and between strange boats that were canoes, outrigger canoes. He knew that, but how? He got to his feet and almost fell. He was shaky, bad off, felt hung over. He turned around. Green jungle seemed to leap out at his eyes, a dark forested tangle of vines and broad leaves and lush blooming flowers that were as pink as a chorus girl's nipple. He was bewildered again. What was a chorus girl? For that matter, what was a nipple? A macaw screamed at the sight of him, flew away blindly, crashed into the thick bole of an old banyan tree, and fell dead at the foot of it with its legs sticking up. Sat him on the table with his legs sticking up. A mongoose looked at his flushed, beard-scruffy face and died of a brain embolism. In comes Sis with a spoon and a glass. A beetle that had been trundling busily up the trunk of a nipple-palm turned black and shriveled to a husk with tiny blue bolts of electricity frizzing for a moment between its antennae. And start dipping gravy from its yes, yes, yes. Who am I? He didn't know. Where am I? What did it matter? He began to walk, stagger, toward the verge of the jungle. He was lightheaded with hunger. The sound of the surf boomed hollowly in his ears like the beat of crazy blood. His mind was as empty as the mind of a newborn child. He was halfway to the edge of the deep green when it parted and three men came out. Then four. Then there were half a dozen. They were brown, smooth-skinned folk. They stared at him. He stared back. Things began to come. The six men became eight. The eight became a dozen. They all held spears. They began to raise them threateningly. The man with the beard stubble on his face looked at them. He was wearing jeans and old sprung cowboy boots. Nothing else. His upper body was as white as the belly of a carp and dreadfully wasted. The spears came all the way up. Then one of the brown men, the leader, choked out one word over and over again, a word that sounded like Yunna. Yup, things were coming. Rightio. His name, for one thing. He smiled. That smile was like a red sun breaking through a black cloud. It exposed bright white teeth and amazing blazing eyes. He turned his lineless palms out to face them in the universal gesture of peace. Before the force of that grin, they were lost. The spears fell to the sand. One of them struck point down and hung there at an angle, quivering.
Do you speak English?
They only looked.
¿Habla español?
No, they didn't. They definitely did not habla fucking español.
What did that mean?
Where was he?
Well, it would come in time. Rome wasn't built in a day, nor Akron, Ohio, for that matter. And the place didn't matter. The place where you made your stand never mattered. Only that you were there, and still on your feet.
Parlez-vous français?
No answer. They stared at him, fascinated. He tried them in German, then bellowed laughter at their stupid, sheepy faces. One of them began to sob helplessly, like a child.
They are simple folk, primitive, simple, unlettered. But I can use them.
Yes, I can use them perfectly well. He advanced toward them, lineless palms still turned outward, still smiling. His eyes sparkled with warm and lunatic joy.
My name is Russell Faraday, he said in a slow, clear voice. I have a mission.
They stared at him, all eyes, all dismay, all fascination.
I have come to help you.
They began to drop on their knees and bow their heads before him, and as his dark, dark shadow fell among them, his grin widened.
I've come to teach you how to be civilized.
Yunna! The chief sobbed in joy and terror. And as he kissed Russell Faraday's feet, the dark man began to laugh. He laughed and laughed and laughed. Life was such a wheel that no man could stand upon it for long. And it always, at the end, came round to the same place again. February 1975. December 1988. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Stand, Complete and Uncut, by Stephen King. This program was produced by Dan Zitt. Text copyright 1978-1990 by Stephen King. Production copyright 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.